of Hebrews, chapter, end of chapter 10, beginning of chapter 11. At the same time you're doing that, you might open your songbook to song number 144. I was going to have Randy lead that tonight, but he didn't lead it. Somebody else let sing. That's okay, Randy. Don't worry about that. I want to talk tonight about what it means to be saved by faith. This is a major theme in the New Testament, and one that I think the more you study it, and the deeper you get into it, the more you appreciate it, and the more you realize there is to learn. And the more encouragement you get from it, the deeper you go into it. It's a fascinating topic. In song number 144, the third verse of that song, the opening line says, "While life's dark maze I tread, and grief around me spread, be thou my God." And the songwriter goes on to call upon God to guide him through this dark maze that we live in. I don't know if you've ever thought of life as a dark maze, but I have. If somebody came to me a year ago and said, "A year from now, you're going to be living in a condominium in Nashua, New Hampshire," I'd have said, "You're insane. That's not happening." But life is like a dark maze because we stumble and wander our way through it, and we don't know what's behind the next panel or the next doorway, and we hit a dead end, and we have to turn around and go some other direction, and we face surprises, and we can't predict what's going to happen. A couple of years ago, my daughter, Jessica, went to school with my oldest daughter, and you probably recognize the statement from knowing her. It's the kind of thing she would say. A couple of years ago, she was talking to me about her future, trying to figure out what she should major in, what school she should go to, and what classes she should take, and what if she gets married, what if she doesn't, and all these different things that she had to face. And she was confused. And she needed guidance, and she called on her daddy, and I said, "All right, well, let me help you with this and help you with that and give you these ideas." And finally she got so frustrated, she said, "Daddy, I need to know what's going to happen in the future." I said, "Well, I'm no prophet. I can't help you there, you know. We all would like to know what's going to happen in the future, wouldn't we?" But God hasn't given us that. What He's given us instead, something called faith. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, the Hebrew writer has gone back to the book of Habakkuk at the end of chapter 10, and he's pulled out a principle that is so profound that it's repeated three times in the Bible. It's from the book of Habakkuk. He quotes it in verse 38, where he says, "Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him." We're going to talk about that verse a little later on. But from that premise, the Hebrew writer then launches into what we call chapter 11, this long, lengthy discussion of the power of faith, how we, in fact, are saved by faith, and how we can find the righteousness of faith that God has intended for His people to follow. But before doing that, he says, let me explain to you what faith really is. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. I put that word assurance there in yellow because I want you to think about what it means to be assured of something. The root word, of course, of the English word assurance is sure. It means being convinced and 100% sure that something's going to happen. Now, as far as things that are in the future, that's hard to do, isn't it? I can be sure of things that have happened in the past, but I can't be sure about what's going to happen tomorrow. I might get run over by a bus tonight. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But faith says we have some assurance about things hoped for. Hope is a reference to things that are going to happen in the future that we're looking forward to. And the challenge the Hebrew writer puts in front of us is to be sure about things that are in the future, number one. Number two, about things we haven't seen. How can you be sure about stuff you haven't seen? Boy, that's a challenge, isn't it? But look what else he says. In verse 6, just a little bit further down in the context, the Hebrew writer says, "But without faith it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of those who diligently seek after Him." There's two propositions that the Hebrew writer puts there, and these are foundational to what I think God has always wanted from His people from day one all the way down to today and however long this earth lasts. These two propositions are the foundation of everything. Number one, you've got to believe that He is. Kenny Chumley talked about that a few weeks ago, all about all the evidence and all the things we can see around us that convince us that God is, and the complexity and the diversity of life. And the fact that you're here tonight means you probably believe that God is. That's not too hard to accept. Even somebody who's not too bright can go out at night and look up at the stars and say, "Wow, an intelligent, powerful God must have made this." King David said, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." It's not hard to believe that God is. I think we can deal with that. The hard part is that second part that comes after that. Once you recognize who the true God is, and maybe many people in the world don't know the true God, they may know other gods or idols or whatever, but once you understand who God is, all right, that's not really the hard part. The hard part is the second part. Must believe that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Lots of people, and I've met lots of people, who believe that God is, but they're not really convinced that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. Because if they believe that, their lives would be completely different. Now, the inverse of that, of course, is that he also punishes those who don't seek him. And that goes along with that. You have to kind of believe that. He rewards those who seek him. Oh, and what's going to happen to those who don't seek him? That kind of is inferred by that, although the Hebrew writer doesn't say it. But those are the two foundations that faith is built on, that faith has to have in order to be successful. It's a conviction of things not seen. It's that dark maze problem that I brought up a minute ago. The Hebrew writer uses the example of Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 8, where he says, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going." We're stumbling around in a dark maze, aren't we? Abraham was. No roadmap, no directions about exactly how far it was going to be, how long it was going to take. And not even going to own the land he's going to, just going to sojourn and wander. You go out not knowing where he was going. That's kind of a metaphor. The Hebrew writer uses that as a metaphor for life. Life is like that. We all don't know where we're going one day to the next. We have plans. Those plans get disrupted. We have surprises that come along. We have challenges to our faith. We have things that we weren't counting on. We have disappointments. We have surprises. We have discouragements. We have temptations. All of which, if I'd known they were coming, I could have planned on them better. But if I knew they were coming, well, this passage wouldn't mean anything, would it? This is about not knowing where you're going and having to be prepared for all the things that are going to come up, even though we don't know what they are. The Bible says the solution to not knowing what's going to happen is faith. And the Bible calls on us to be like Abraham. Habakkuk 2 and verse 4 contains this short little statement. The just shall live by faith. That the New Testament writers found so important that they repeated it twice. I believe that that statement is the foundation of man's response to the gospel. I almost put on the slide that that's the foundation of the gospel. That's not true. The confession that Peter made, that Jesus is the Christ, Son of God, is the foundation of the gospel. This is the foundation of man's response to the gospel. Once God has done what he has done by providing salvation through his Son, the fact that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and God provided him as the sacrifice for sin, okay, that's what God did. He has done that. The question then is, what do I do about it? Well, I can say, well, okay, I accept that. Okay, fine. What are you doing about it? How does it affect the way you live? In Habakkuk 2 and verse 4, the prophet is distinguishing between those who are not in God's favor and those who are. And the ones who are the ones who live by faith. They're the just. They're the ones who are going to endure even when the hard times come, even when the judgments and the punishments come. The prophets are always talking about the gloom and the doom and the destruction on sinners. But the just will live by faith. In Romans 1:17, after the powerful verse that Paul writes in verse 16, where he talks about the gospel as the power of God unto salvation, he then goes on in verse 17 and says, "For in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." This is what you're supposed to do with the gospel. You're supposed to follow what Habakkuk said about the just will live by faith. That's your job, is to respond to the gospel and demonstrate it in the way you live. And then in Hebrews 10:38 that we just read, the Hebrew writer picks it up again and says, "Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back," what's that? That's an insufficient faith. That's a faith that didn't get people from earth to heaven. That's a faith that did not endure through the hard times, did not endure the persecution, did not endure the temptations. A faith that caused someone to get only a certain distance along the race of life, along the race of being a Christian, and then they gave up, they drew back. The temptations were too great, the persecution was too heavy, the challenges were too hard. But of course, that's not really the problem, is it? When a person draws back, gives up, finds temptation to be too great or persecution to be too bad, the problem is not in the temptation or the persecution. The problem is in the faith. Insufficient faith is why people draw back. Insufficient faith is why people quit serving the Lord. We can point to all of the external problems and reasons, but those are excuses. Those are just circumstances. The reason people stop serving God and draw back is because of insufficient faith. Because the just live by faith. Later on in Romans, Paul goes on to talk about the righteousness of faith. When we talk about righteousness, we're talking about getting right, the state of being right with God. In some, you can call it a legal sense, you can call it a moral sense. And in the first three chapters of Romans, Paul, just to summarize it in 2 seconds and way oversimplify it, Paul talks about the fact that we could look at mankind and try to serve God in accordance with law. But if we did that, we'd find that everybody's condemned. Nobody has the righteousness of law keeping. Everybody's failed at that, except for Jesus of Nazareth, of course. But everybody else in the Gentile world and in the Jewish community, they all failed at keeping God's law. So if God were to judge mankind by the righteousness of the law, everybody would be lost. There'd be no hope for anyone. And that's why we need the gospel. When we have the gospel, we have this other means of salvation, other than perfect law keeping. And this other means of salvation is the righteousness of faith. And that's the conclusion that Paul draws in Romans 4, after he spends three chapters talking about you're not going to be saved by law keeping. Instead, you need to seek out the righteousness of faith. Look what he says. Go over to Romans chapter 4 and verse 13. He says, "For the promise that he would be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of no effect. Because the law brings about wrath. For where there is no law, there is no transgression." The argument that he's making thus far is that even the great man Abraham, far better man than I'll ever be, I suspect, a man who accomplished a lot more than I'm ever going to accomplish, a man who demonstrated his faith in ways far more powerful than I ever will, even a man that good did not find salvation, did not find a relationship with God through law-keeping. Instead, what he found it through was through the righteousness of faith. And if that's the way Abraham was saved, if that's the way he found a relationship with God, Paul argues that's the way God wants us to seek him as well. The law brings wrath because everybody's violated it. So what are we going to do instead? Verse 16, "Therefore it is of faith that it might be according to grace. We're to come to God in faith, trusting that his grace will save us." Because he's promised it. And God will save us through his grace and through his plan of salvation, not because we've kept his laws perfectly. So that the promise might be sure, there's that word again, remember that word assurance? The promise might be sure to all the seed, not only those who are of the law, the Jewish folks, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Now he's making a lot of arguments about the Gentiles and Jews that we're not going to come to talk about tonight. But the bigger picture is, if anybody's going to be saved, they're going to be saved like Abraham was. Through the righteousness of faith, not through the righteousness of law-keeping. And if they come to him in faith, if they seek that righteousness of faith, then he says, you better understand that the promise will be sure. And those who come to him with that assurance are going to find salvation through the righteousness of faith. He will make you righteous. He will justify you and cleanse you of sin, even though we've broken his laws. God can fix that problem. But it depends on our response. And it depends on maintaining that relationship with him through faith. I have to point out, of course, there are some things that a saving faith is not. Although the Bible often calls Christians believers, in fact, it's one of the most common terms in the New Testament for Christian. The word Christian is only used three times. The believers used dozens of times to describe New Testament saints. The Bible also draws a distinction between mere belief and a saving and living and active faith. And I think you already know that. There's a couple of real powerful examples that you're probably familiar with. James chapter 2 and verse 19. James mocks those who think that they're in good shape because they believe in the one God. Well, even the demons believe that. So what? That doesn't prove anything. In John 12 verse 42, it says, "Many of the rulers believed on him, but because of the Pharisees, they would not confess, lest they should be put out of the synagogue." So just understanding and accepting who God is, who Jesus is, that's nice, and it's a good... Remember, that was number one on the two things the Hebrew writer said you got to have. You have to believe that he is. Okay, that's nice. you're halfway there, but there's one more thing, and he's a rewarder of those who seek him. And that's where the Pharisees stopped. They said, I'm not going to seek him. I understand who he is, but I'm not going to seek him. Okay. Then you don't have a saving faith. You have some level of belief. John said they believed, but that's not a saving faith. That's insufficient faith. And it won't get anybody from earth to heaven. It won't get them very far at all. The righteousness of faith, James explains it even further in James 2. He says, but you want to know, foolish man, that faith without works is dead. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. He was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. James is not arguing that Abraham earned a relationship with God because of the amazing works that he did. That's not his argument. His argument is that his works demonstrated his faith. And that Abraham's faith was so powerful. And that his faith was so, what's the word? Such a powerful example to us. And sufficient for God to say, I'm going to make him a righteous man. Even though he hasn't earned it, because of his great faith, I'm going to save him. That's how God looked at Abraham. And James says, that's the way you ought to believe. You ought to have that same kind of faith, a faith that motivates you to do whatever God calls upon you to do, whenever he calls upon you to do it, no matter how hard it is. And that's a challenge, isn't it? That's a challenge. I want you to take the next step, though, and think carefully about the context of James 2. While it's true that James 2 certainly teaches that one cannot receive salvation through the initial obedience to the gospel simply by, as many of our religious neighbors believe, simply having a faith-only plan of salvation. James 2 certainly defeats that theory. But who's the book of James written to? Later on in the chapter, James talks about calling for the elders of the church if you're sick and having them. That's not unbelievers he's talking to. He's talking to believers. And to believers, he says, you need to stop thinking you can be saved by faith only. Because there's a temptation to say, okay, well, I've received Christ through obedience to the gospel. Great, now I'm saved. And my ticket's punched, and I'm on the way to heaven. And I can kind of cruise along. And James says, well, wait a minute. Just a minute there. A saving faith is a lifetime commitment and an everyday responsibility. It doesn't stop at the moment of obedience to the gospel. A sufficient faith is not one that is merely sufficient to get us to the waters of baptism. The faith, in order to be sufficient, to find the righteousness of faith, it has to go a lot further than that. Again, baptism is a good start. But what about a faith that gets us through every persecution, every temptation, every trial, and everything that we don't know that's coming? How about a faith that gets us through all of that? There's a sufficient faith. That's not easy to find. I want to give you some principles to consider about salvation by faith. Things to think about. That faith will do and that faith can do. I want to challenge you tonight to think about my theory anyway. If you study this at home, see what you think. My theory is that insufficient works suggest insufficient faith. I spent some time a year or two ago trying to counsel a family that had a problem, a spiritual problem. The problem was their attendance at church was just miserable. They were on what we call the associate membership plan, kind of once a month, you know, kind of show up. And we went and talked to them and said, you know, this is just not good. What about your kids? And you know, they're not getting the spiritual background, and you're not worshiping God like you should be. And you're not encouraging others, and others can't encourage you, and all these reasons why you need to show up. And they'd rather be out on the lake, and they'd rather be sleeping in. Or it was just this big burden to show up at worship. And I thought, what can I say to motivate these folks? And after some time of pondering that and praying about it and studying it and thinking about it, as I was putting this material together some time back, I finally realized what the problem was. I realized there was probably very little I could do. If a person's not motivated to worship God, that's the symptom of the problem. That is not the problem. Failing to believe that worship is important, failing to show up for worship, or failing to do many other things, failing to clean up our lives, failing to put away whatever it is in our lives that's not right, failing to demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit in our behavior. On year after, I don't mean somebody just obeyed the gospel, I mean year after year after year, as time goes on. Failure to make the kind of changes that we need to make, failure to show the kind, even the minimal kind of works that would demonstrate that we care about the Lord. We could nag somebody about the works. You've got to show up. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. And I could nag them about the works. And we have some level of duty to do that, I suppose. But isn't the real problem with insufficient works, isn't the real problem insufficient faith? Because, think about it. If someone believed that God is, and that He's a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him, upon the world would just leap in Sunday morning, if you really believed that. Because God's ready and willing to bless you and to reward you if you diligently seek Him. If you're sleeping in, that means you really don't think He's going to reward you for seeking Him. It means your faith is insufficient. The insufficient works are the symptom. The root cause is a lack of faith. I submit that to you and ask you to think about it. I would suggest also that faith overcomes the worries and the anxieties of life. Turn over to Luke chapter 8 and verse 25. Luke 8, 25. This is a story that we studied in our Bible class a few weeks ago on Sunday morning. It's a story of the apostles are in the boat with Jesus. The boat is out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. A big storm comes up. They're in danger. They're in serious danger. These are experienced fishermen, but they wake up Jesus, who's sleeping down in the boat, and they begin calling upon Him. Master, Master, we're perishing. Verse 24. Then He arose and rebuked the wind and the raging of the water, and they ceased, and there was a calm. But He said to them, where is your faith? Jesus said the root cause of why the apostles panicked in the boat was lack of faith. Now, I want to challenge you a little bit. Think about this. Did they wake up Jesus at the first drop of rain? Did they wake Him up at the first bolt of lightning or the second? Did they wake Him up at the first gust of wind? I don't think so. I think the disciples believed that they had waited a sufficient time before waking Him up. But Jesus said the fact that you guys panicked is evidence that you have insufficient faith. I think they thought they were doing pretty good to wait for a while before they woke Him up. But Jesus said, that's not sufficient. You didn't have enough faith. What a high standard that is. That challenges me a good bit. In Matthew 6 and verse 30, you know, we have hard economic times in this country. We have people losing their jobs. I know firsthand about that. Many of you do too. We're going through tough times. And those can be causes for worry and anxiety about financial things. I understand that. I wouldn't trade what we have now, though, for what they had in the first century Roman Empire. I wouldn't trade our economy for theirs. And in talking to people who had financial worries and concerns about how they were going to eat and what they were going to wear, look what Jesus said to them. Matthew 6:30. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown in the oven, will He not much more clothe you, you who have legitimate concerns about the state of the Roman economy? No. What He said was, will He not much more clothe you, you have little faith, you see. When people panic and worry about their economic circumstances, Jesus said, that's little faith. That is an insufficient faith. You are worried about the economic circumstances. But that challenges me. I've gone through 3 layoffs in my career, okay? First two, I violated that verse. I panicked and worried. Shouldn't have. I'm ashamed of that, but I did. But each time I got a little better. I started praying more. This time I didn't panic and worry. I said, this time the Lord's going to solve this problem. And He did. My point in all of this is not to talk about me, but to talk about this right here. We serve a God big enough to solve every problem we have. I'm convinced the two biggest problems that mankind has are sin and death. And you know what? God has a solution for both of those. What other problems have you got that's bigger than that? The God we serve can solve every problem. If you don't believe that, I don't know why. I don't know why you'd be here or why you'd want to worship Him if He can't solve every problem you have. Those who come to God must believe that He is and that He's a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. He solves problems for people if they diligently seek Him. I believe that. Faith will accomplish great things. Matthew 21, verse 21, Jesus answered and said to them, and in the context, he's talking about the fig tree that he had cursed earlier. They came back and saw the fig tree, and they were amazed that it had withered after he had cursed it earlier on. Jesus said to them, assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. I don't think there's any evidence in the New Testament that the apostles went around blowing up mountains and changing the landscape of ancient Roman Empire or anything else. I don't think they did that. I think he's speaking metaphorically here, and that is that we all have big mountains that get in the way. We have big challenges that sometimes that are bigger than we can solve. Problems that seem insurmountable, a mountain that we couldn't possibly climb. How do you get over or around or through that mountain or get the mountain out of the way so you can get to the other side and get to where we need to be? There's the answer. Jesus said, if you have sufficient faith, you can cross that mountain. You can get that mountain out of the way, and you can get where you need to be. And the Lord will get you there if your faith is sufficient. The history of God's people, I think, is a history of either a sufficient or insufficient faith. Those are the two guiding principles that determine the success or failure of God's people throughout Bible history. In Luke 7 and verse 50, even in this little incident that we see here, the sinful woman comes in uninvited to the house of the Pharisee where Jesus is eating. The Pharisee suspects that Jesus must not be a prophet because why would he let this woman be at his feet? And Jesus tells a story about forgiveness and so on. But I want to focus on verse 50. Then he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Now, what did the woman do to get to that point? Well, she took a risk by coming into someone's house uninvited. She did a lot of things. She was crying. She was wiping his feet with her hair. She was calling upon him. She was doing all of these things. Those were all the outward symptoms, the outward evidence. But what saved her was her faith. She wasn't saved just because she was crying. She wasn't saved just because she came into the house. She wasn't saved just because of this, this, and this. She was saved because of her faith. Hebrews 11 goes on to give the long list of all of those great heroes of the Old Testament, and about how much they accomplished. And every time it says, by faith, they did this. By faith, they did that. By faith. Every single thing they did was because of faith. And it was a sufficient faith to allow them to succeed where others might have failed at trying the same thing. On the other hand, when God's people failed, wasn't it always because of their lack of faith? Think about Bible history. Was there ever a time when God's people had sufficient faith and God let them fail? Was there ever a time when they had insufficient faith and God caused them to succeed? I think they always, these two things always go together as far as I can tell. Matthew 17 and verse 19. When they come down from the mountain of transfiguration, they discovered that the disciples who were left behind and did not come up on the mountain had been trying to cast out a demon and had failed. And that surprised them. Surprised the people in the community. There was some disputing going on. Why did they fail? What happened? Matthew 17, 19, the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not cast it out? And the answer was not because the Holy Spirit was insufficient to give them power. The answer was not, well, what was the answer? Jesus said to them, because of your unbelief. How about that? For surely I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain. The same thing we saw before. You could move the mountain if you had even a sufficient faith. You failed to cast him out because of insufficient faith. That's why they failed. Hebrews 3, verse 10. Going back to Old Testament Israel, describing them as the example. It's a lengthy discussion of how Israel fell in the wilderness, how they failed to make it to the promised land. And the conclusion in verse 17, now with whom was he angry? 40 years, talking about the 40 years in the wilderness. Who was God angry with? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? Now you might stop there and say, okay, well, obedience caused them to fail to enter the promised land. And that's true, it did. But look at the next verse. So we see then they could not enter in because of unbelief. Why did they not obey? Because their faith was insufficient. That was the root cause. It wasn't just the failure to obey. That failure to obey was caused by insufficient faith. They really didn't believe that God was a rewarder of those that diligently seek Him. They didn't think He could get them into the promised land was the problem. He's not really going to reward us if we really try this. And so they failed. Faith will determine your ability to understand and appreciate spiritual teaching. Matthew 16 and verse 6. Disciples have forgotten to take bread when they get in the boat. Jesus said to them in verse 6, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, it's because we have taken no bread. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, what did he say to them? You have little faith. What was their problem in not understanding the parable about the bread and the leavening of the Pharisees and Sadducees? It was not the fact that they weren't smart enough to understand it. They were intelligent. And even if they hadn't been especially intelligent, they could have understood this. It was not that their IQs were not high enough. It was not that they didn't have a deep theological understanding of the Old Testament, although I'm sure they didn't, and probably should have known it better than they did. But that's not the problem here. The problem is not some physical failing on their part that they were incapable of understanding what Jesus was saying. They could have understood it. Otherwise, it wasn't fair for Him to rebuke them. They could have understood it if they had had a sufficient faith. Insufficient faith causes people not to be able to think clearly about spiritual things. And when people find Bible study boring or unsatisfying or unhelpful or unwilling to do it, that's evidence of an insufficient faith. Because people with sufficient faith find Bible study fascinating. They find that it feeds their soul. They find that it gives them what they're looking for. And they begin thinking about spiritual things all the time. They don't have to be told, okay, we need to start thinking spiritually. It's part of their nature. And the teachings of Jesus are not confusing and baffling to them. They're ready and open to accept them when they come. I suggest that faith will get you from earth to heaven. If you haven't figured that out by now, that's where we're headed, of course. Hebrews 11, verse 13, these all died in faith, talking about all these heroes of the Old Testament he's been talking about. They all died in faith, not having received the promises. Okay, there were lots of things unfulfilled when Abraham died, when all these other people died, Moses, all the others. They all died with a lot of these things unfulfilled in their lives. But having seen them afar off, were assured, there's that word again, they were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. But those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. You ever thought about that? You ever thought about the fact that Abraham and Sarah, if they'd gotten tired of that whole thing of waiting for a child to come at our age, and all this traveling around at our age, and all this stuff, and going to some country we don't even know, and all these people we don't know, and all that stuff, the Hebrew writer says if they had thought about it, they could have turned right back around and gone home and said, you know what, this is too hard, forget it. You know what kept them from doing that? It's their faith. And you and I have that same opportunity. Any time or any day that you decide that the path that the Lord has laid out for you is too hard or too difficult or too dangerous or too complicated, you have the opportunity to return. I don't encourage you to do it, but you can turn around and give up any day that you want to. Whether you do that or not will be determined by your faith. A sufficient faith will get you from earth to heaven, just as it did all those who went before us. Faith will determine your happiness in life, how you view the future, whether it's going to be a depressing failure and disaster or whether it's going to be full of blessings from God. It's really based on your faith, isn't it? Faith will determine your outlook on life. It'll determine your priorities, what you do, whether you put spiritual things ahead of physical things, whether you put financial things and secular things ahead of godly things and spiritual matters. The choices you make about those priorities will be determined by your faith. Your faith will determine your ability to influence others. If you're not 100% convinced that God's a rewarder of those who seek after Him, how are you going to convince anybody else of that? It ain't going to happen. It'll influence your prayer life. James 1, 5 through 7 talks about the double-minded man, the man who's not sure whether God's really going to answer his prayer or not. His faith is shaky and weak. James says, don't even bother. Those prayers won't be answered. And of course, it'll determine your final destination when this is over. The last thing I leave you with is Mark 9 and verse 23. This is, again, this is Mark's account of the story of when they came down from the mountain and the disciples failed to cast out the demon. And as Jesus is conversing with the man, the father of the child who had the demon, Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believes. The man's face is getting shaky because he's seen the disciples fail. So he's not sure if there's really power here to do it. But Jesus said, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believes. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. And maybe all of us find ourselves in that circumstance. We all find ourselves with some degree of belief. Hopefully it grows over the years. Hopefully it's more today than it was yesterday, and it's way more today than it was 5 years ago, or whatever that may be. But a sufficient faith will be evident in the way you live. It'll be evident in the way you pray, and it'll be evident in the way you talk, and the way you study the Bible. And it'll be evident, of course, with the God of heaven, who knows each one of us and knows the hearts. If there's anything at all we can do tonight to help you in your service to God, to help you develop a greater faith, or even to help you turn to God in faith for the first time, by coming to Him, confessing that Jesus is the Son of God, and receiving baptism into His name, in order to become a child of His, let us know while we stand in silence.